We have been.
We have been. It's 15 minutes past 1. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Gatto, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramirez, Representative Aaron, Representative Lynn. We are working our way through House Bill 324, the bail bill, and we're happy to have Sue McLean here again to take us through the bill. Sue?
Thank you.
Take us up where we left off, please.
I can find where we left. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were finishing up Section 7 when last we spoke, so next section will be Section 8 of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it rewrites the provision addressing appeal from the conditions of release. The bill requires the person to follow the procedures adopted for asking the court to amend the conditions. And a little, I talked about that a little bit before. There's another provision of the law where the court, we proposed that the provision of the law which allows the court to amend conditions of release without a procedure doesn't give a proper opportunity for people for the parties to speak to that. The appeal procedure in a trial court's bail decision is similar to current law, and the standard to allow a court to review another court's bail decision is the same as current law. The appellate court shall affirm the lower court unless it finds that the lower court abused its discretion. And this is also similar to current law. Essentially, this section simply governs if a person wants to appeal the conditions of release or the amount of bail that has been set in his or her case. I don't think that there's any dispute about this, to follow up. Section 9 adds a new section addressing the temporary release of a person for an emergency, such as the death of a family member. It's very similar to the bill that's currently in effect, that is that it allows certain people to be released for certain reasons from when bail has been set and they've been unable to make bail, and that's a temporary type of a release, sort of a furlough. I know we usually use that word with respect to corrections, but it's similar to that. It would require the court to solicit information from the Department of Corrections before releasing the person to make sure that the person's conduct while incarcerated indicates that the person will be a good risk for release. The provision provides that the court should order the person to appear back in court at the end of the release before they're returned to a correctional facility. And I don't think there's any dispute about that either.
We've been joined by Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Sue, you said that there's no issues of this. Why do we need this section?
We need the section because it does put limits on who may be released temporarily, and it does track current law, which I believe passed the legislature probably 4 or 5 years ago, that indicated that not everyone is eligible for temporary release. So the reason that we need it is to clarify who and who is not eligible for a temporary release from the conditions of the release. And frankly, the reason that the statute was passed those years ago is because a person was allowed a temporary release, went out and got into a terrible accident, and the results were very bad, and there was an uproar about why that person had been released from jail on a temporary basis.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, so please proceed.
Thank you. Section 10 addresses release of persons who've been found guilty, excuse me, but who haven't been sentenced or who are pursuing an appeal. It allows release under the general provisions of AS 1230, but it requires the person seeking release to establish by clear and convincing evidence that the release sought will reasonably assure the person's appearance and the safety of the victim, other persons, and the community. It is similar to current law in that under current law, certain defendants may not be released after being found guilty, including a person convicted of an unclassified or a Class A felony. The current statute also prohibits release of people who have been convicted of Class B or C felonies if they have a prior conviction for certain serious felonies. And this is the one I mentioned at the beginning that attempts to correct the problem that the court noted in Bourdon versus State, where a person who is convicted of a sex felony can be released, but a person who's convicted of, say, a Class C felony who has a prior sex felony couldn't be released on bail. So this part of the aim of this is to correct that provision of the former law or the existing law.
Representative Gatto has a question on this
yes.
point.
Thank you. Can a sexual felony be A, B, or C?
Through the chair, yes, it can. My understanding is, I am aware of some defense attorneys being objecting to this provision, but the source of their objection has seemed to be that there should not be ever a case in which a person can't be released on bail pending appeal, and to that objection I would add that law already exists. Section 11 makes clarifying changes to the law pertaining to release of material witnesses. It allows a material witness to be detained long enough to take a deposition. And the reason that this, I am aware of one person or one defense attorney who has objected to this on the ground that it allows for the arrest of a material witness. In fact, under current law, the arrest of a material witness is authorized. A court can always it's within a court's inherent authority to take whatever steps are necessary to assure the appearance of people before the court. And there is a case entitled Raphael versus State that provides that in doing that, the court can't be coercive. So this section aims at clarifying the existing law, setting out that the person should be held long enough to take a deposition, and adding that the court retains the authority if, in the interest of justice, it's necessary to detain the material witness for longer. That envisions a situation, for example, where a person is told to give a deposition and continues to refuse. And at that point, the parties would have the ability to put the witness on the witness stand in front of the jury.
We've been joined by Representative Gruenberg.
Section 12 specifies that a person who is in custody with a petition to revoke probation does not have a right to release, under current, under AS 1230, and this is the same as current law. The probationer may request release. The bill provides that the probationer must establish, again, by clear and convincing evidence, that the conditions of his or her release will reasonably assure the appearance of the probationer and the safety of victims and the community.
Could I ask a question?
Representative Gruenberg.
Apologize for being late, but I just would like to go back to Section 11 for a moment, please.
Okay.
Ms. McLean. What is it? You're repealing and reenact two questions. First, on page 14, line 22, there's a reference to AS 1230-011. Maybe I have that here somewhere. What does that say?
1230-011 is the provision of this proposed legislation, which incorporates all of the new, all of the conditions of release.
I see, okay. Number two, this is being repealed and reenacted. What is the change in Section 11 from the current statute? You know, just in 25 words or less.
The change is that it specifically says that a judicial officer may order the arrest of a person, which current law does not say. Current law is somewhat vague in that it says if the court, I won't read it, if the court is presented with evidence that suggests a person won't appear and testify in response to a subpoena, the court may release them on conditions. It's fairly obvious that in order to be released, they need to be released from something. So this just makes it clear that the court can issue an arrest warrant for them.
May I inquire?
Mm-hmm.
If you're arrested because you're a material witness, does that go on your record?
Through the chair, I don't...
As arrest?
It would go into the police records. It would not be part of your criminal record.
So there would be a record that you've been arrested. Is there a way, I mean, I'm concerned about, and I don't know much about, I've never had this come up, somebody would have a police record that says they've been arrested just because they were a material witness.
Through the chair, perhaps I wasn't clear enough. The police have to make a record if they've taken someone into custody. They can't just arrest someone without making a record that a person has been taken off by them. But that record is not available, for example, when the officers in the squad car look up a person's criminal history. That won't be pulled up.
May I, Mr. Chair, please? Does the person then, if they're asked later, have you ever been arrested? Do they have to reveal that they've been arrested because they were a material witness?
Through the chair, I don't mean to be flippant, but I think it would depend on who's making the inquiry. For example...
Employer.
A lawyer?
An employer.
I think it would depend on the employer.
Mr. Chair, if I may, right now, if you're taken in, quote, taken into custody as a material witness, since it doesn't say you're, quote, arrested, is it truly an arrest? Because the thing, you can see what I'm getting at, folks. And we may need a, quote, amendment, God forbid, here. Because I don't want somebody to have to say they were arrested.
Through the chair, if you're taken into custody now, you're arrested. The court has issued an arrest warrant, and it's been served on you.
What does Section 11 have to do with the governor's mandate on sexual assault and domestic violence? Anything? I mean, maybe the answer is nothing, and it's just...
I don't, respectfully, Mr. Chair, I don't see a direct relation here. What it has to do with is to make sure that witnesses who are recalcitrant are able, their testimony is able to be taken by either party that wants their presence in court.
After we, one moment, after we go through the bill, if you could point out the sections that relate directly to the sexual assault and domestic violence initiative, and those that just relate to updating the bail statute would be helpful for me because of the, you know, we were, when this was initially framed by General Sullivan, you know, all three of these bills were grouped together. They were clustered together under that umbrella. So I just want to be able to separate where we're updating the statutes and where they are unique to the charge of, you know, let's go address sexual assault and domestic violence. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sue, help me to understand this. I wish I had the legal background that you did and could understand this. If I'm a material witness and it, would I know that I was a material witness? Is it a possibility that I would know? And the reason I'm asking is if it came to my attention that I was a material witness and I went to the police department or troopers or whoever was FBI appropriate and said, you know, this is my name and I'm a material witness and I'm here and would like to talk with you, do I need to be arrested?
Through the chair, no. This the situation envisioned by this provision is that the person has been served with a subpoena, or there's an attempt being made to serve the person with a subpoena, and they are resisting or have been served and have literally called up whichever side has served it and said, I'm not coming.
I'm not coming. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grimberg. Maybe we need to have a more detailed discussion about this at some other point here. But I'm concerned. Somebody comes to the door. Maybe it's late at night, early in the morning, and somebody, the homeowner, is just angry and says, hell no, I won't go. And that's just a spur-of-the-moment kind of a thing. And then they're, quote, arrested, and they've got to reveal it to employers. And
your next campaign.
Well, thanks.
Through the chair.
Your next campaign.
Sure. Your opponent.
If I may respond, the vision, what I envisioned, when you said, would there be a record of a arrest, the answer is we can't have a society where people are taken into custody and no record is made of it.
No, of course.
So in that sense, a record would be made. I would think if a person was applying for a job that had a very high security clearance, they would have to reveal that. I would think it would be found by the people who are doing their background check anyway. But that's what I thought of when you asked that question.
Mr. Chair,
I'm
thinking many times people are asked, like it, maybe if you want to be a teacher or whatever, have you ever been arrested? And that's the kind of thing I'm thinking of. And what I'm thinking of, and maybe you can put your good mind to work here, maybe an amendment or something that would say that this shall not be considered arrest for, right. And I'm not sure how we do it. But
well, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Perrin and then Representative Gatto.
Mr. Chairman, Sue, are there different types or categories of material witnesses that I think my friend next door here is trying to allude to? I mean, should there be severe cases of material witnesses and not so severe?
Through the chair, a material witness is a person who has information about a case. There would never be an arrest of a material witness without a judge having considered someone, either the defense or the prosecution's application for a warrant, because a material witness has indicated that they won't appear. So within that inquiry would be an inquiry about whether or not the person is material. I would like to come back, however, to the question, have you ever been arrested? And that is, I would just say, as far as I know, as an employer who does a lot of interviewing, that isn't a question that most employers can ask anymore. It's, have you ever been convicted? It's a difficult problem if you're a teacher. Mm. I can't go into a long, not prepared to answer that, fully researched. It's just a question that is not routinely asked in most arenas anymore. The question is, have you been convicted of a crime?
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Is there a connection between placed in protective custody and being arrested?
Through the chair, being placed in protective custody is governed completely by Title 47, which pertains to mental illness or debilitation. And with respect to that statute, the protective custody provisions require that the arrest, it's not an arrest, that placing a person into protective custody until they are either sober or committed or well is absolutely confidential. It is not on a person's record. However, that's a good example of it's certainly on the police's record because they've had the person in their care and they have to make a record of it.
Mr. Chair. I was thinking of it from the point of view of the victim. Can the victim be placed in protective custody while they're scouting the neighborhood for the perpetrator, and then the only way to do it is to arrest them? Or can you do it without arresting them?
Through the chair, I can't think of a situation in which a victim would be arrested as a material witness at the time the police are investigating. I can think of situations in which the victim might have to be arrested as a material witness in the middle of a trial because he or she is refusing to show up. But I can't think of a situation where the police would place someone in protective custody, the victim of an offense, during an investigative stage. Rather, they would go everywhere looking for the offender.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, sorry, excuse me. I'm looking at the text on page 14, line 17 and following. If the prosecution or defense establishes, et cetera, that the testimony is, number one, material, and number two, quote, that it may be impracticable to secure the presence of the person by subpoena. That language, Ms. McLean, is quite different than what you've just said. Number one, it doesn't require the previous service of a subpoena. Number two, it doesn't require anything other than it, quote, maybe. It doesn't show require a very high standard. And it doesn't require a refusal. It just, the term is impracticable. That's a considerably different standard than the one you've been talking about. Comments? I think we have to look carefully at the drafting of this section.
Please.
To conform to what you've said. I will be looking at it.
I wanted to make sure before I told you this tracks the language of the current statute.
You would talk about this tomorrow or something?
Yeah. I mean,
I want this through the chair. We've got to deal with the issue of what you say to your, you know, how people can handle this later. And number two, I think this language needs to be tightened.
And through the chair, this language has been the language since 1966. That's what I was looking at. And it may be that now that we're looking at it, we find it loose, but it has been the language since 1966. I would say to you that the requests and granting of material witness warrants are very rare.
Yeah.
They are.
Thank you.
I know. I'll just let it go at this point, Mr. Chair, but these are some things I see anyway. And it may be, frankly, that if the practice is, as you've said, then maybe the practice is different than the technical language in the bill, and if so, that's something we should consider. That's my questions on that one.
Go ahead, sir. You're doing a great job.
I think we had finished with Section 12. Section 13 is simply a conforming amendment. Section 14 makes it clear when a conviction occurs for purposes of the bail statute that person is convicted when the person is found guilty either by verdict or by a plea. Section 15 adds the definitions into the bill. And sections 16 through 18 are conforming amendments. Section 20 and 21. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Could I ask a question, please?
Representative Grimmer.
Section 14. I've always felt just intuitively that was, in fact, well, I don't have any problem with Section 14, but this is the first time you're really setting out at what time somebody is technically guilty. Am I correct?
Through the chair, we're setting out when a person is convicted.
Yeah. The reason I'm saying that is because if in a civil case the person isn't legally responsible or liable in the civil sense until the judge signs the judgment. And here, in a criminal case, the judge signs the judgment also, a judgment of conviction. But you're moving up the time for conviction from the time the judge signs it to the time the jury renders the verdict or the plea is entered. And that may be quite a lapse of time, because, number one, it's prior to sentencing. Number two, it is prior to the time for the decision on any post-conviction motions. Is this a change in the law?
Through the chair, for the most part, no. The subject of when a conviction has occurred comes up in many different contexts in the criminal law. For example, in presumptive sentencing, when is a person convicted is when the guilty verdict has occurred. But over the years, it's been a matter of great debate about when convictions have occurred. If a person, for example, commits a crime after a guilty verdict but prior to sentencing, are they a second offender? And the answer depends. If they have an SIS, are they convicted? The answer is they've never been sentenced, but for purposes of presumptive sentencing, they have a prior conviction. So what this bill tries to do is explain when they are convicted for purposes of the bail bill.
May I follow up, please?
Yeah.
I want to skip to the thing I'm interested in here generally, ma'am, is the changes the bill makes in current law. So why don't we talk about what changes Section 14 makes, specifically run down the changes this little section will make in current law.
Under current law, excuse me, through the chair, I do not believe there is any provision that says when a person is convicted for the purpose of statutes pertaining to things like bail pending appeal. That's why it's there, is to make it clear. Although we've been proceeding as though it was clear because the statute, for example, already provides that once a jury returns a guilty verdict on certain charges, a person is taken into custody. But it makes it very clear about when conviction has occurred.
May I, for the purpose of sentencing, right now, if, let's say, a person has yesterday been, the jury has returned a verdict of guilt on a certain charge. Today they're back in court on another charge. They plead guilty. Would this then be considered a second offense, or is it not a second offense because the judge has not yet signed the judgment of conviction?
That is probably one of the most, excuse me, through the chair, litigated issues that comes up. Not exactly in that context, but it comes up now in context of does the sentence that the first judge is imposing run, has it taken into consideration the other offense? And if I may, I just would like a moment here. The person is not regarded as convicted for purposes of, for example, a DUI. It's not a second DUI if they haven't been sentenced on the first one.
Go ahead.
And other than that, I would like to research this question and come back to you and tell you where the differences are.
Mr. Chair, I know these are not easy questions, and I'm coming from a basis of a lot of ignorance here. And Sue, if on any of these you would like to respond in writing, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'd really like to have a complete answer. And these are friendly questions.
I will get you one.
Understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we'll get it to the other members of the, we'll get it to the chair and other members of the committee then if we go.
All right. Section 19. Provides that service of domestic violence protective orders on respondents need not be made by law enforcement officers if the respondent has already been served with the protective order on the record in court. That obviously pertains directly. Violation of a DV protective order requires that the state prove service of an order. The current statutes pertaining to protective orders require that the defendant be served by a law enforcement officer, and this simply clarifies that if, in fact, the person is in court, usually on the criminal part, you know, the crime that underlies often the DV protective order, that if they've been served in court with a protective order, it's not necessary for a law enforcement officer to go find them and serve them again.
May I inquire?
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. It sounds like there's no problem. I just am wondering, is there any technical difference on line 15, page 16, between the word process and the phrase court's order? The reason I'm saying that is because, at least on the civil side, you're not served with process unless you're served with a packet of documents, the complaint, the summons, the pretrial order, et cetera, the assignment order, et cetera. What is there a difference here? Because you could have a judicial DV order, but that wouldn't necessarily, since this implicates the civil area, be totally served within the meaning of Civil Rule 4. I think you should clarify. And I think it should require that it only counts if all the documents under process are served on the person in court. And I certainly support it if that's the case.
Through the chair, I will look into that, but the documents at issue in a DV case are often simply an injunction, and what is served on the person at the time is a copy of the order that the court has issued and the application that the victim has made to receive the injunction, which is similar to the complaint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just requires a copy of the court order, not the DV petition, and I think we need to change that term so that we make sure that that, along with anything else, is served. And if you could take a look at that, I want the phrase court's order to be completely inclusive so that the person in court gets the same documents they'd get if the policeman came to their door.
Through the chair, I'd like to research that.
Sure.
I can think of some reasons why part of what's being sought here is expediency.
But we should not forget due process.
No, we should not forget due process.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sections 20 and 21 are amendments to Rule 5 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. Current law requires that a person who has been arrested be brought before a judicial officer within 24 hours. The bill changes that from 24 to 48 hours. The preferred procedure is always to have a person brought before the court as quickly as practicable. There are times when 48 hours is simply needed. There are times when it's not possible to get a person before a judicial officer in less than 48 hours. And there are times when 48 hours is needed to do enough of an investigation to determine whether the person should continue to be charged.
Representative Goddard.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I need a clarification, because if we go back to line 4, beginning with unnecessary delay, so we say unnecessary delay does not exceed 48 hours. Should it say
it's on page 17, line 4.
Pardon me?
Page 17, line 4.
Sorry. No. Should it say unnecessary delay is defined as a period exceeding 48 hours after arrest?
Through the chair, the English teacher in me says that it says the same thing either way, but I'm willing to
maybe I can. I understand what you've said, and I was kind of looking at Mr. Wolliver seated there in the background. I can see circumstances where
for example, somebody's out in the bush and you can't bring them in or something. I'm very loath to change existing law generally in something like this. However, if there are extraordinary circumstances, I could see going up to 48 hours. I would prefer to keep it at 24 unless the judicial officer makes a finding that under these circumstances, up to 48 hours is okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Yeah. The question was a matter of English.
Yeah.
And I cannot imagine
right.
does not exceed and exceeds as in any way being the same statement.
Through the chair, I thought about it, and really, the other way to correct it would be to say necessary delay does not exceed 48 hours.
Oh, necessary. You are, okay.
I stand corrected. We have to make one of those two corrections.
So we need an amendment or?
Probably.
Necessary delay.
Yeah.
Yeah. One or the other.
Right.
So necessary.
So, Mr. Chair, that would put the burden on the public safety folks to say, there was a necessary delay, and that's why we couldn't get the person here in 48 hours. That seems reasonable.
Correct.
Okay.
And I, Mr. Chair, I guess that would go in both of these sections, 20 and 21.
21.
Okay. Am I right?
Right.
Maybe you don't need to, through the chair. Maybe 21 doesn't need to be amended. We're just talking about 20.
Right. Through the chair, 21 precisely says that the mm-hmm. law enforcement right. has to be bring the person before a court within 48 hours. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Section 22 and 23 are conforming amendments. Section 24.
Are we on 23?
23.
And we didn't do 20. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry.
I'm sorry, too.
Right.
Section 24 amends Criminal Rule 41 to provide that a court may not change or add to a bond requirement without the agreement of the surety. And that directly comes from complaints we've had from sureties who say perhaps this is the scenario. A person has been arrested, released on a bond. They go out and commit a new crime. They are brought into court, and the court orders their bail, quote, concurrent with the existing bail, and the surety is not aware that he is now insuring against a person who's committed two, or there's probable cause to believe he's committed two rather than one crime, and that's been an objection that the bail bonds people have had. Section 25 is also a conforming amendment. Section 26 amends the appellate rules, specifically Appellate Rule 603A, to provide that that the person whose conviction is being appealed may be allowed as provided to be released under AS 1230. Simply tracks the appellate rule with the rule regarding release pending appeal. And Section 27 through 29 include all of the repealers for all the laws we're repealing in the interest of streamlining this law and the effective date of the law. The chairperson had asked me to go through this and point out those provisions which affect directly or indirectly, I assume, domestic violence and sexual assault. To some degree, Section 1 does, in the sense that, as we talked about when last I was here, if a person fails to appear, the entire process comes to a halt, and a victim who is promised reasonable a reasonably prompt disposition of the matter doesn't get it if the offender has failed to appear. Furthermore, if he's failed to appear, he may be presenting a threat to the victim. Section 2 is simply a conforming amendment, as we talked about, to make sure that probable cause. We have two different sections, one of which says reasonable cause, one of which says probable cause, that probable cause is the operative language in both sections. Section 3 certainly is very directly related to domestic violence, sexual assault, in that it seeks to stop, I think, for lack of a better word, the practice of having bail review every day, the next day, and the next day, and the next day, all of which the victim must be notified about, and all of which victims in these cases become very upset about, their fear that the person will be released on bail. It simply gives more time for a person to, for the prosecution to notify the victim, for the victim to think about the release that's being proposed, and specifically provides that the court, in considering release of the offender, must take into consideration whatever the victim has to say about release, which is not the current law. And if I may, there had been some suggestion to me that we add in section F on page 4 of the section, line 26, begin section F. There was some suggestion that the judicial officer shall consider these comments, that we add and any response by the person whose bail is being considered. We wouldn't object to that change.
May I inquire?
Representative Goldberg.
Having been involved in many cases, number of cases anyway, that involved GALs, guardian ad litem for minors, this implies, but doesn't specifically say, that the court may appoint a GAL for the minor at that point in time. Normally, at least I'm not aware of any requirement or maybe even any ability for a court to appoint a GAL for a minor or incompetent person in a criminal case. And this gives the minor some standing, at least, to make comments. Is there any statute that gives the court the ability to appoint a minor in that situation? I mean, no, not minor, but a GAL.
Through the chair, I'm not aware of any statute that allows, well, I think it's been a long time since I read the GAL statute, and my recollection is that the court has quite a bit of discretion, but I'm not aware of whether there's a statute that specifically allows it in a criminal case. As a practical matter, if a minor is a victim of an offense and there isn't a parent or a guardian who speaks in the place of a parent, it often happens that there are other civil proceedings in which a guardian ad litem has already been appointed.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Civil rule on the subject is 90.7, title, Appointment of Guardian Ad Litem in Child Custody Proceedings. And my recollection, has been a long time since I've looked at those statutes, too, in the cases. I don't recall any mention of appointing a GAL in a criminal case. And I can think of several circumstances. One where the child is a victim, one where the child is a material witness. And I would, if you could do your research, let's take a look and see what the extent of the court's authority to make such an appointment is. And Mr. Woolover, maybe we can ask you that at the appropriate time. Maybe you're the person to ask. But I'd like to get an answer.
Section 4 probably is, many of the provisions of Section 4 have a direct impact on sexual assault and domestic violence. They set the conditions of release. Some are specific to those crimes. And Section 4 is what will be the new AS 1230-011, which synthesizes all of the current statutes setting out conditions of release into this one statute. But many provisions of this section either directly or indirectly pertain to conditions of release that are necessary to protect a victim from further violence.
Ms. Holliday.
Similarly.
Now, Section 4 is also the section that the ACLU has the most objections to and thinks will trigger the most amount of lawsuits against the state of Alaska. Can you speak to
I can.
The trade-off here in safety for the public versus liberty for the accused.
Respectfully, I do respect the ACLU, this almost all of the conditions in this statute already exist under AS 1230-020 and 029 and 023. We already have statutes that permit a court to impose a condition of submitting to a breath test if you as a condition of release. We already have a statute that allows a court to order that you not be around people that are using drugs. The ACLU's letter, which I have read, referred to a suspicionless search. And this statute tracks the old statute in that an officer, first of all, a judicial officer must have ordered the condition of release. And secondly, the police officer must have a reasonable suspicion that the person is violating the condition of release before they can order the person to submit to a breath test or submit to your analysis. But almost all of these, and I did bring to your attention the couple that are different are existing current law. The couple that are different are that the court can order someone who's taking medicine to continue to take it, and I believe the ACLU had another objection, which was that the court can order a person to maintain employment or seek employment. And often when a person seeks release, and typically they're seeking release on their own recognizance, one of the reasons they're offering is that they will lose their job if they're not released, or that they need to go look for a job, and this simply gives the court the power to order that they do what they've asked to be released to do.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Bruinberg.
Representative Gatto asked a question a few minutes ago that I didn't think you really answered. And it dealt with protective custody. He was not talking about a civil commitment for a person who has mental illness or disability. I thought what he was talking about was when the peace officers and the prosecution felt they needed to take somebody into protective custody, not because the person might not show up, but for the person's own protection so they don't get harmed by the defense. And we're going back to the section we looked at on material witness, whether that was Section 11 or whatever it was, I don't remember. That seems to be limited to a circumstance where they're not sure that the person's going to show up. It doesn't give any authority for the prosecution to put them or detain them or do something
civilly. That wouldn't be considered for any stretch of the imagination an arrest, but you're taking them to a place that's safe. This doesn't seem to speak to what Representative Gatto was talking about, and I think we should have a provision that allows that.
Representative Gatto, is that a fair characterization of your question?
My concern was mobs and gangs who have so many alternative ways for warnings and retribution that you now need to protect the victim. Mm-hmm. And so you do that by taking them into custody, and then we thought, was that an arrest? That's where it stemmed from.
All right, thank
you. To prevent
you.
Intimidation.
Okay, Sue, if you could comment on that.
Through the chair, to the best of my knowledge, we have no statute in Alaska right now that allows a court to order that a victim of an offense be taken into any kind of custody to protect the victim. Instead, we have a system by which we've provided support to a variety of shelters, but whether or not a person enters a shelter is completely voluntary.
Madam Chair, I really do think we need to look at the Gatto issue here, and maybe it's in this context of Section 11 or something else, but you need to have the ability to do that to protect the witness, I think.
And just to follow up on that, Representative Grunberg, so I make sure I understand you, are you suggesting that, if I understood Sue correctly, she said it's there already in voluntary form, you're wishing that it be in law that it's not voluntary, that someone might make that decision for the person, that they're not safe and that they are required to be?
That's one of the issues. There's a famous Steve McQueen movie, Bullet, where this was the whole subject of the whole movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah, so do I.
Let's bring it in, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The Mustang.
The Mustang, yeah. But one thing is involuntariness. Number two is to provide the ability, financial, et cetera, to put this person not just in a shelter, because as those of us who know and love the movie, they put him in a hotel room there, which wasn't totally safe, but it's a lot safer than putting him in a shelter where all kinds of people know where they are. And I want to give the prosecution as much ability to protect their witnesses and people as possible.
Follow up, Sue?
Through the chair, our problem typically has been that people have asked for that, and we have no means to fund it. I do have some problems with the idea that we would take a person into involuntary custody. I must say that, but the victim of an offense. But people have asked for that, and there isn't any funding source that directly addresses that.
Madam Chair, involuntariness, I don't know that we need to get into that. If they don't want to do it involuntarily, I'm not necessarily saying they should, but we need to authorize them to do it, and then the appropriation can take place. Right now, there's no authorization.
Okay, and then another fiscal note would come with that, too, correct?
Yeah. But at least, I'm not sure. You'd have to see how it would work out, but I would say that if we need that, and it's an occasional case, it wouldn't be very large. Mm-hmm. But it could be absolutely key in the cases that Representative Gatto's talked about, mm-hmm. particularly. Okay.
Section 5, which provides for the appointment for standards for a third-party custodian to have some qualifications, affects domestic violence and sexual assault by making sure that an offender is released into a situation in which the offender actually will be kept away from the victim, as opposed to, for example, releasing to someone who cannot tell whether or not the offender is home because they may not be able to physically perform the duties, releasing to someone who may have themselves pending charges and some indication that they wouldn't abide by the law and therefore won't help the other person abide by the law. So I think it directly relates to make, you know, a third-party custodianship a meaningful thing, a meaningful release.
Sue, Representative Perrin has a question.
Sue, I'm third-party custodian. We're drafting this legislation or trying to improve the laws with the initial focus on sexual assault, domestic violence. But the way we're writing it, doesn't it, it'll include a 19-year-old that's minor consuming alcohol, and they can't find a third-party custodian, so he ends up being in jail 4 months. I mean, are we trying to write the law for sexual assault, domestic violence, like the chairman said, or are we just trying to have one size fits all here?
Through the chair, I was speaking this morning with one of the aides, and I said to her, and I say to you, what maybe you don't see if you're not in the trial court every day, is that the vast majority of cases the prosecution agrees to release. They agree to release on recognizance, on simple conditions like don't drink alcohol, you know, or maybe if you're a 19-year-old, that you not be around anywhere where there is alcohol because legally you can't be anyway. That's the vast majority of cases, and this doesn't change that. It doesn't mandate that the court order up a third-party custodian in lieu of an OR release. What it does seek to do is protect against that situation where a third-party custodian simply is not capable of, for whatever reason, that there isn't any protection for a victim in releasing someone to a third-party custodian. So do you have one size fits all? Yes. Could you differentiate that third-party custodians only have to be qualified in cases of domestic violence or sexual assault? I don't know how you could do that without offending equal protection. On the other hand, I will say to you that it is cases of domestic violence and sexual assault where the state is most often concerned about release and release that will keep an offender away from a victim. That's all, the only answer I have for you, Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Section 6 is not substantive, but it pertains directly to domestic violence. It basically conforms language that pertains to domestic violence.
Sue, Representative Gatto has a question.
Sorry?
To keep the defendant away from the victim. We do that by saying you can't go to their home. We talk a little bit about you can't go to their place of employment. Can you go to Walmart and run into them? Can you? I mean, how do we actually accomplish something like that unless we stipulate that the defendant may not come any closer than 500 yards or some exact numerical number?
To the chair, we often see that as a condition of release. The court, it's always the charge of the court to come up with some mechanism that will keep the offender from being a threat to the victim or to the community at large. And sometimes a third-party custodian is the best way to do that because it's a place where the person has to be in at night and be accounted for and be in someone's sight and sound. And that person won't, and if the condition also is you won't telephone her, then it's a violation if the third-party custodian sees them telephoning her. It's basically a way to step up, I guess, the court's ability to supervise and make sure that that won't happen. Can we say you won't be with, you know, you won't see the person at Walmart? In fact, what courts typically say to a person who is released on conditions where there's Title 41 crime, a crime against a person, is if you see them, turn the other way, walk away from them, you know. Mm-hmm. That. Do we charge conditions of release for inadvertent passing in the night? No, we don't usually do that, but it's, I don't think there's any piece of paper that's going to absolutely guarantee that someone won't be endangered, and sometimes another human being, like a third-party custodian, adds to the security of the person who feels threatened by the person who's charged with the crime.
I've been trying to figure it out myself.
I don't know.
Looking for some numeric formula that concerns distance and time. It's almost like an equation.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
Have there been any circumstances here or elsewhere where a third-party custodian has been put in danger as a result of their acceptance of the appointment?
Through the chair, we did have a person who was released to a third-party custodian, and they were drinking together, and he killed the third-party custodian. That was last summer in Bethel, up river from Bethel.
So the custodian and the defendant were out drinking, and the custodian wound up getting socked or something? Oh.
Killed.
Okay.
Killed.
Uh-huh. Not bright. That's the only one?
No. I think there are, it happens frequently through the chair, that custodians, there have been situations in which custodians feel threatened by the defendant, and that's why their qualifications are important. Mm. Sometimes, for example, the mother or the grandmother might be a custodian, and that person might just call the police and say, I can't control them. Mm-hmm. Then we file a motion to end that third-party custodianship, or the custodian simply brings them to the police station and says, I can't do it anymore. But, you know, can we ensure the safety of everybody?
No.
We can't take away all the spinning wheels. We just do the best we can.
Thank you.
All right. Was I at Section 7? Section 7 is directly related to domestic violence release. And it's aimed at ensuring that there is this cooling-off period and that the offender will not move back into the residence of the victim without some safeguards in place, and not immediately. Section 8 is about the appeal from the conditions of release. Everyone should have a right to appeal whatever happens in court. Section 9 is not directly related to domestic violence and sexual assault, but it's tangentially related in the sense that a person who's being temporarily released would have an opportunity to come in contact with a victim, and this sort of limits the circumstances under which that might occur. Obviously, release after conviction, Section 10, protects the victim from retribution by the offender who has just been convicted and may seek retribution. An offender in that situation also has every reason to flee. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
I'd like to go back to Section 8 for just a moment, if I may. The last sentence on page 13, line 4, the appeal shall be determined promptly. Is there an appellate rule that now requires that, or are the appellate rules going to have to be conformed to that requirement? Because there are some appellate rules dealing with expedited appeals, and they include such things as election appeals. There's a special rule on that. Child custody appeals. And I was on the Appellate Rules Advisory Committee at one time. I don't remember if appeals from conditions of bail are expedited as well. Do you, or maybe Mr. Woolover knows that? Or
Mr. Woolover may know that better. I would do the same.
Representative Greenberg, are you asking specific questions about the bill, or are you talking about proceeding through which sections are relevant to sexual assault? Or are you just...
It deals with this section of the bill. It has nothing to do with sexual assault, okay. My question, if you don't mind.
Well, I kind of have a format that I'm following.
Well, then I'll withdraw that.
Thank you.
Maybe at some point we can get an answer to that from somebody.
Thank you.
Sorry.
It's 20 minutes after, too.
Sorry.
And Mr. Mittman with the ACLU would like to testify, and before that, Doug Woolover would like to make some remarks on behalf of the court system. So my objective was to kind of go through this and see how many sections formatted to the governor and the attorney general's initiative, and then hear from Mr. Woolover, who's in the room, and then listen to Mr. Mittman, and it should leave ample time for you to pursue
my apologies.
Some of your interests. Stay with it, Sue.
Yeah.
Section 11, release of material witnesses. Sadly, these are the cases in which we see witnesses often who don't want to appear, and it's sometimes it's the victim of an offense. Sometimes it's a person who doesn't want to be put in a position of testifying against someone they perceive as threatening to them, and so they try to choose the option of simply not appearing. Section 12 deals with petitions to revoke probation. Again, it could have a lot to do with sexual assault and domestic violence if the violation of condition of probation is that someone had contact with the victim or that they've committed a new crime. And again, the sexual assault and DV crimes are the ones where we most often see big arguments occurring about conditions of release for people who are in violation. Section 13 really only is really a conforming amendment to current law, which requires that cash posted be held as surety, in some cases for a victim, against restitution. Section 14 relates to DV and sexual assault only to the extent that those are crimes included in being convicted. Section 15, to the extent that it defines sexual felony and stalking, has to do with DV and sexual assault. Section 16 through 18 are again, conforming amendments. Section 19 is directly related to the interplay of service of a DV protective order when a person is both in criminal and civil court. Section 20 that seeks to amend Rule 5 has the ability, if a person can be held or needs to be held for 48 hours, sometimes part of the problem is that the victim has a right to be notified of the court's the person's court appearance, and it gives the prosecution more time to locate the victim and notify the victim. That's Section 21 is the same. Section 22, dealing with release pending appeal, gives the court a lot of criteria to consider when considering release pending appeal, including some factors about the offender, including their criminal history, which may bear on whether or not the person is going to pose a danger to others while on release pending appeal. Section 26, as we talked about, simply conforms the district court rule amendment. So regarding appellate rules, and so that's for all intents and purposes a conforming section, as are all of the remaining sections.
Thank you, Sue. Sue, are more people going to spend more nights in jail as a result of the way we're revising bail restrictions?
Especially the ones that flight.
Yes. The short answer to that question is yes.
That's the same conclusion the chair reaches, so I probably will ask Mr. Peoples to come up and explain why there's a zero fiscal note for the Department of Corrections, because it seems that we're going to be handling prisoners with people that are incarcerated that are coming to and from. I mean, that seems to be the whole notion of how this relates to the governor and the attorney general's initiative on domestic assault and or sexual assault and domestic violence, is to try and keep the bad guys away from good people and good communities for a little bit longer. So that's a concern for me that I'm going to need some assistance in grasping. And if you would, Sue, if you would sit tight, Representative Holmes has a question, and then if you would sit tight so that when Mr. Mittman is on the line, if we want to use you to rebut some of his assertions, I'd appreciate it. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my question actually kind of follows up on yours, which is, I got a whole stack of fiscal notes in front of me, and the only one that seems to not be a zero is from the court system, and the court system seems to contemplate a lot of additional bail hearings and a number of bail hearings that are going to last anywhere from, you know, twice as long to 3 hours. And I'm kind of wondering why, if the court system is, I think, conservatively, and I think they use the word conservative in here a couple times, if they're conservatively estimating these additional bail hearings and the additional time in the bail hearings and the additional need for court system employees, et cetera, I'm kind of wondering why not just the court system, Mr. Chairman, but the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, and basically everybody else is saying that this isn't going to cost any additional money when we're going to be, according to the court system, spending a lot of extra time and people are going to be spending more time in jail.
Through the chair, our position, well, first of all, anyone who's in jail has a bail hearing. It's that simple. So what the court system is talking about is bail hearings that are longer. We don't see this increasing the length of bail hearings that much. I know that the court system does, and that is part of the job that our lawyers are already doing. What is different about it is that there will be more criteria that will be considered when a person is being released on bail than are presently being considered. And to that extent, there are things that will help our prosecutors move more swiftly. For example, I cannot tell you the number of hours we spend listening to applications for third-party custodians where the person who's being proposed clearly cannot be a third-party custodian. The most recent one I heard of was last week when a grandfather was charged with sexual assaulting the children, the grandchildren, and the grandmother was proposed as the third-party custodian, and she had custody of the children. But the point is, court was convened. We had a bail hearing. We went through the questioning of the grandmother, and so on and so forth. So I recognize that the court system thinks that there are going to be more and longer hearings. Our response would simply be, nobody gets released at all without a bail hearing. Usually they're short. And Mr. Wolliver, to his credit, has indicated that most bail hearings don't take more than 15 minutes, and we still don't think they would take more than 15 minutes. There will be some where the defendant will have to bring in some evidence. As a practical matter, that sometimes happens now because they know the state is going to be asking for high bail, and so they come prepared. The defense comes prepared. They've got a third-party proposal, or they've got a release-to-treatment proposal, and those bail hearings can take a little longer. 3 hours seems to me to be very long. I would say an hour is not unreasonable. I think there have been hearings that have been longer, and we don't know how it will play out, but our sense of it is that it's not going to be that different. Because we have to have a bail hearing in every case as it is.
Thank you. And you can sit tight or grab a seat if you want for a few minutes. Sue, Doug, would you come up and offer your testimony on behalf of the court system, please? And then, Mr. Peoples, if you're comfortable, we'd love to have you give us a couple of minutes of how we arrive at a zero fiscal note and the neutrality of these things on the correction system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. And like a lot of these big bills, we have worked closely with the Department of Law and the Public Defender and OPA, and I talk with people a lot on the issues, and I can go over specifically our fiscal note, or I can address some other issues in the bill that we have. Maybe I'll start with some concerns we have, and I'm around all the time, so the next time you come up, if you'd like to move on to Jeffrey Mitten or something, that's fine. There are a couple of concerns we have about the bill. One of them, and we will probably be asking that you consider removing a section of the bill, and that's the section that requires the court clerks to produce a criminal history report for judges. There is this is a fair bit of extra work for the court. This information is largely redundant because the prosecutor has already presented the criminal history of the defendant, and if not the first bail hearing, then certainly the first review, because this only applies to the second review. The information presumably only applies to electronic records that we have, although the bill doesn't limit it to electronic records. If court clerks go through all of the paper.
Can you direct us to the...
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman. It is page 4, lines 14 through 16. Now, we've talked with law about this. I don't know whether they agree with me or not on this. They're aware of our concern. And it says the court obtains a report from the clerk. Even if this is limited to electronic records, this is information the prosecution already has direct access to, just like the court does. There isn't any special information that only the court clerk can obtain. And in general, in the adversarial system, the court does not do independent fact research on the case. It's the duty of the parties to bring the relevant information to the court's attention. That's how it works in other areas. That's how it works in the criminal law. If the Department of Law or the public defender believes that somewhere in the criminal history is information that's relevant for the court's bail decision, it's the responsibility of those parties to bring that information to the court. And finally, there isn't any real connection between this report and whether or not the court grants a bail review hearing. All the court has to do is have this report. There isn't anything in there that the court is going to find that says, oh, wait a minute, I'm not going to grant this bail hearing after all. So it doesn't really serve a purpose. To the extent the information is useful, the Department of Law already has access to it, as does the public defender. And at the appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, we'll ask that the committee, or maybe perhaps someone can introduce an amendment to remove that. But a couple of other concerns we have are very, I'll skip some of the really minor particular ones. I don't think we have a problem with the Department of Law that might be, we can clarify. There is a concern, and I normally wouldn't comment on this kind of concern because it really is substantive and doesn't directly impact the court, but it does deal with the third-party custodian. On page 11, lines 8 and 9, you had mentioned this, Mr. Chairman, earlier. This is anybody with a Class A misdemeanor in the previous 5 years may not be appointed as a third-party custodian. Mostly the rural judges ask that I comment on this. It is, as you may know, difficult to find third-party custodians. And their concern is it will be extremely difficult to find third-party custodians with blanket rules such as this. It would apply, as in your scenario the other day, Mr. Chairman, with a DUI conviction 4 years ago, would preclude you from being a third-party custodian, though under the facts of the case, it might be very appropriate. So we're not asking for a change, but because you know, maybe you'll decide that is the appropriate standard, but we did want you to know that. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Susan, for the record, it is page 11, but it's lines 21 through 23.
Okay. I'm sorry if I had that wrong.
Okay. Sorry.
We'd just like you to be aware that in many circumstances, that may be a restriction that would preclude an otherwise appropriate third party from...
We will see an amendment on that.
The one other section that we just kind of need a clarification on is the section that applies to sureties, and that is on page 18, lines 25 through 27. The court may not change or add to a bond requirement that was ordered in a previous proceeding unless the surety agrees to the change or addition. I understand the Department of Law's concern about the current practices. I think that they've identified a real problem. The only concern I have with this one is that any change to the bond requirement, even if it's not relevant to the surety's interest, could be stopped simply because the surety doesn't even respond. The concern about concurrent bail is an issue that I agree probably should be clarified. And I can work with the Department of Law to come up with language that does that without unnecessarily stopping countless bail hearings.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. So would you say was ordered in a previous proceeding unless the surety instead of agrees to the change but has been notified of the change?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I don't suspect that would be enough to satisfy the Department of Law's concern, which is maybe notice an opportunity comment or something along those lines, where appropriate, something like that. There's another section that requires them to receive notice. This one requires notice and approval. There are many cases where the surety probably would not approve of the change and should know of it, but we can finesse that language to, I think, address Law's concern without creating hopefully a bottleneck. I can talk to you about assumptions in my fiscal note, or you can listen to Mr. Mittman or whatever the chair prefers.
I think our concerns aren't the fiscal note that the court estimates. I think the concern is the lack of a fiscal note coming from other agencies, I think, is more reflective. So are there any other questions for
thank you. I was hoping we could touch. I agree with you that my main concern goes to the zero fiscal notes from others, but I am a little curious about a few aspects of the court fiscal note.
I'm just mindful of the clock, so
Mr. Chairman, and I unfortunately didn't get much of a chance since I just saw the fiscal note when I sat down, but it talks about I don't know, I was just hoping that we could hear a little more since I just sort of sat, there's like two or three pages of text on the fiscal note and I haven't had a chance to really, we could do this on later if Mr. Wolliver is available.
Okay, perfect, we'll do it later.
Okay,
Mr. Peoples?
Could I ask a question?
Representative Greenberg.
I had a couple of questions. One concerning the court's ability to appoint a guardian ad litem, and it came up at the bottom of page 4, lines 26 to 29. Does the court have the ability now in statute, case law, or court rule to appoint a GAL in a criminal case?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I have in my notes here for me a question to answer regarding that question. I don't know the answer, though. When I read that provision, I assumed that what it was referring to is any victim who happens to have a GAL already. So there isn't a parent to testify. So if there's a GAL, the GAL could do that. But I can find out the court's authority to appoint for a victim, a minor victim. Yeah,
I'd appreciate your doing that. And there was one other place.
Section 8, do the court rules have a current provision that require prompt appeal? I also have that noted as a question for me to answer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate it. Mr. Peoples?
Your notes are better than mine.
Yeah, I feel you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Peoples, thank you very much. Just very briefly, because I want to reserve the balance of the afternoon for Mr. Mittman with the ACLU to address his concerns. But would you just take us through how we get to a zero fiscal note with corrections, please? Through the chair, for the record, Duane Peoples, Department of Corrections. If you have the physical note available, I would address you to the second page, the second paragraph. The department has been unable to really determine an accurate fiscal impact in the terms of dollars. What this bill will do is it is going to be dependent upon what sort of delays you have on somebody getting out of jail on bail. A total sentence, let's just say I have been found guilty and sentenced to 90 days. If I had spent 30 days in jail during the pre-adjudication period, gotten bail, those 30 days would basically be attributed to my sentence. So for the net effect, depending on how pleading goes and everything else, the number of man days I would be serving will not change, because in the end I'm going to have to do the 90 days. Where the impact will come is not in the total net effect of man days, but where those man days are served. The impact will be in the jails, the community jails, which there are 15 scattered throughout the state and most of our unsentenced facilities. Quantifying that, we have not been able to do. We have raised a flag on this in our narrative saying it's going to be an impact, it's going to hit the jails, we don't know. And it may not be a significant impact if the courts function real fast and if there is not a significant delay. If there is a delay, then we'll probably be shuffling people around more. We'll have more man days, not so much more man days, but more movement of prisoners if we have to relieve pressure in the unsentenced facilities. So, Doug, I appreciate that as it relates to regular business. I keep trying to refocus the committee on the charge we have from the governor and the Attorney General to be doing a better job with domestic violence and sexual assault, and the notion, the rebuttable presumption, and those sections that Ms. McLean took us through that are really germane to separating dangerous people from their families and communities within which they're hurting people, should result in more people going to jail for more days. I think that's the inference that I drew when we were presented this back in January, when we first took up the first of these three pieces of legislation. So if it's more man days, then presumably it would generate a positive fiscal note, and so the court system. I'm inclined to see things in a in percentages. So, Doug, I don't know what our it takes to operate, operations in the court system, and so I don't know what $800,000 is or $676,000 is as it relates to operations. You know, if that's a 2% increase, and if we should look at an overall 2% increase to the cost of incarceration in the correction system, but to arrive at zero when the purpose of this is to incarcerate people for a longer period of time, to me seems a disingenuous fiscal note. And when the Department of Law says, yeah, we're going to send more people to jail for more days, and then it comes back a net neutral, it just feels like we're doing the correction shuffle a little bit, with all due respect. But what do you think? Am I off? Am I thinking logically or rationally or not so? The question then, I think, is the man days. Is this bill, as drafted, going to increase the length of sentences?
And I hope would so. Do you?
I will defer that to Ms. McLean.
That's what I would do too. I mean, Sue, isn't that the objective? I mean, isn't that the charge?
The purpose of the bail bill is to protect the public. And is the purpose to make sentences longer by making people sit in jail longer pretrial? No, it's not. It's to protect the victim while the person is awaiting trial, to protect the victims and the public, to make sure that the offender doesn't flee. As a practical matter, it would be difficult for me to say whether it's going to result in longer sentences. I mean, there's always a, I guess, there are parameters of sentencing which won't change, but the goal of the bail bill is not so much to make sentences longer, but to protect the public while the case is pending. It doesn't add to the length of sentences per se.
Boy, you're not winning me over with layman's logic here, Representative Heron.
I guess following that in-state track or in-state pipeline track is Dwayne. Does this package of sexual assault, domestic violence laws, is this going to make it easier for you to go to OMB and say, hey, I need some more money because I have this pilot project over in corrections for sexual assault, domestic violence, offender treatment? I mean, that's where I'm following up on the chairman's lead here. So, I mean, really, doesn't it mean that these laws we pass, we're going to ask people to stay in jail longer, and then we're going to have to try to treat them, hopefully, at the end of their, or during their stay in jail?
Through the chair to Representative Heron, taking this bill and putting this aside and talking about the gestalt, yes.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, well, I'm going to look forward to, I would really appreciate if corrections would revisit this fiscal note before Wednesday when we're considering moving this bill out. It just doesn't seem consistent to me with, is it Friday, is that when we're moving? It doesn't seem consistent to me with the objective, what the governor's asked for and the attorney general has asked for, that it doesn't result in some kind of a positive, I'm hopeful that it does result in a positive fiscal note for the correction system. It doesn't seem like it's working if it doesn't.
To the chair, for us to come up with an accurate quantification at this point in time will be difficult. I will go back and review it, especially upon, and take a look at Mr. Wolliver's fiscal note. I think what you might want to conceptually view our note as is an indeterminate. We don't know where the impact is going to be. It depends upon how it slows down. We do know it's going to hit the unsentenced facilities and the community jails.
Okay. So maybe then if we arrive at an indeterminate fiscal note, we can work on a better effort to determine what the increment is at the initially while they're working through the court system, and what the decrement would be in mandates at the end. I understand it's like an algebraic equation that you're saying that if they spend an extra 20 days during pre-sentencing and it counts toward their time served, that it's coming off the back end. But I'd like to understand with a little bit better than, you know, shucks, we don't know, how the two pieces fit together, because it feels like the front end is supposed to get more expensive for the benefit of the public good, and then there may be a decrement that comes off the back end if it's a 90-day sentence and they have served 20 days waiting in jail because of a prior criminal history. Maybe they serve the first 20 days over here, and then it takes 20 days off of their sentence over here. If I understand, but I'd like to see a more thorough effort in articulating the fiscal note, please.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. All right, and so let's spend the last 10-15 minutes that we have with Mr. Mittman. Sue, you're welcome to stay here and offer a rebuttal to any questions that come up specifically from the committee. Jeffrey, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I've perused your letter, and it seems to focus on sections 1, 4, and 5. And so you might give us a survey of all of the relevant sections and then come back and focus on a pure section 4 causes the most concern for the ACLU.
Certainly. I thank the chair. And again, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska. And what we focused on in our testimony is our analysis of those provisions of the bill as drafted, which we believe present significant constitutional challenges. And rather than repeat the testimony that we've submitted in writing, I thought it might be helpful to committee to simply go through with page and line references as to the particularly problematic language, if that would work for the chair.
Please go ahead.
Okay. On page 2, lines 4 through 6, this is the language that asserts that the failure to appear does not require a culpable mental state, and as more fully outlined in our written testimony, essentially the courts generally will approve what's called a strict liability standard for minor or administrative violations. What this would propose, however, is that essentially a person could be convicted of a felony without a specific culpable mental state, or what lawyers like to call in a Latin high-dollar word, mens rea. It is likely that a court would find such an imposition of a felony conviction unconstitutional. Proceeding to page 3, lines 24 through 26, this is the expansion of time from 24 to 48 hours. While clearly for a bail hearing, while clearly in the more rural areas of the state, it may be appropriate for a court to allow an expansion of time by 24 hours in which a person has to have a bail hearing. There's a fairly settled law in the state of Alaska that 24 hours is a reasonably appropriate time to grant somebody a hearing. Our constitutional analysis is based on the fact that when a person is charged, there is, of course, a presumption of innocence. And to improperly or unreasonably hold somebody without hearing, without having an opportunity to determine judicially whether or not they should be held further, a 48-hour standard could likely offend the Constitution. Proceeding next to page 6, again, lines 2 through 4, this is a subsection 6 allowing without specific findings, a court to require a person to maintain employment. Again, this goes back to the constitutional standard that an individual at charging has a presumption of innocence, and it would not be constitutionally permissible to allow a court to essentially meddle in a person's personal affairs. The granting or denial of bail is focused on whether or not, A, a person is likely to appear as a flight risk, and B, whether or not they present a potential of harm to the community. Absent a specific finding that an individual's maintaining or finding employment bears on those two factors, simply establishing a statutory requirement, a statutory permission for a court to impose that factor would be constitutionally suspect. Similarly, and on pages 6, lines 20 through, excuse me, lines 22 through 26, subsections 15 and 16, regarding questions as to medical care and medication. Again, if a court were to find that requiring somebody to take medication was likely to ensure their appearance or to lessen their threat to this public safety, it may be permissible for a court to find that. The problem is that by simply writing it into the statute, you're opening up a gross invasion of a person's medical privacy simply on a statutory basis, which, again, given the presumption of innocence, would not be constitutionally permissible. On page 7, lines 19 through 22, this is the area that we highlighted first in our letter. This is probably the most extremely constitutionally problematic. What this bill would intend to do, as written on this page, is seek legislatively to overturn the Alaska Constitution, which is, of course, impermissible. We cited, too, the legislative history of the drafting of the Constitution, where Vic Fisher spoke about the restriction on bail that was limited to capital offenses where the evidence is great. To seek to legislatively create a rebuttable presumption against bail, against that legislative history, is really constitutionally suspect in the extreme, and we can't imagine the Supreme Court would not overturn it, especially in light of settled case law, the Martin case that we cited. Going to page 8, lines 18 through 22, along with page 9, lines 7 through 12, this is the quote-unquote warrantless search. Again, given the presumption of innocence, you cannot require a person to submit to a search without a warrant. They are essentially forced to agree to give up their constitutional rights because absent that agreement, they cannot obtain bail. And what you're doing is you're putting somebody in a untenable position of being forced to, quote-unquote, consent to a reduction of their constitutional rights, which, again, would be impermissible. And finally, on page 10, lines 28 through the section on imposition of third-party custodians, as we discussed more fully in our written testimony, at the pretrial bail point, the review, the intention, again, is ensuring appearance and avoiding threats to public safety. Third-party custodians were intended as an alternative for individuals who were not able to afford bail, not as additional conditions. Again, in particular, the language that the absence of language that the imposition of third-party custodian would be the least restrictive means is constitutionally suspect. So absent a revision of those particular clauses that we've outlined, we anticipate that there would be, of necessity, challenges to this statute as facially drafted.
Does that summarize it?
It does, the chair. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to present, as I thought this would be helpful in addition to the more detailed summary that lays out the legal framework for our opposition.
It's very helpful to have you walk us through the text. Are there questions for Mr. Mittman from the members? Jeffrey, I don't see any questions. We thank you very much for highlighting these. I would encourage members who have those concerns to follow with Mr. Mittman. Are there any questions for Ms. McLean? Okay, seeing none, it's 3:05. I thank the committee for their efforts, and we are adjourned.